One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our 2020 webinar series. Laura Tingle is the Chief Political Correspondent for ABC 730, and in this episode she talks about her quarterly essay, The High Road, What Australia Can Learn from New Zealand.
Ina mana. Ina mana, ina reo, ina tangara whenua o Aotearoa. E tika ana te kōrero. E hara taku toa I te tō takitahi, he tō takitini kē. Nō reira tātou, e hui hui mai nei. Ka hoaki tono tātou. Tonight, New Zealand has shown the Labour Party its greatest support in at least 50 years.
You know, I am part of a generation that didn't routinely learn Te Reo Māori. Anyone who's heard me with the language will have seen very visibly my attempts to learn the language as I go. And so I'm doing it in a very public way. But I hope as part of that, maybe there'll be more who choose to join that journey with me, and that we have more people learn.
I move government notice of motion number one in my name regarding a declaration of a climate emergency. Government organisations to be carbon neutral by 2025. Mm-hmm. We must get our own house in order. How can we stand and take a leadership position amongst the private sector unless we take the same action that we expect of them?
And this webinar was hosted by a beloved Canberran and board member at the Australia Institute, Alex Sloan, formerly of ABC Canberra, and Laura was in conversation with Ben O'Quist, our executive director. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 9th of December, 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. I'm Alex Sloan, Australia Institute Director, filling in today for Ebony Bennett, the Deputy Director of the Australia Institute. And welcome to our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. This is the final one for 2020. I would like to first acknowledge the traditional owners, the Ngunnawal people. I acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and pay my respects to elders past and present. During the pandemic, the Australia Institute has run these webinars at least weekly. In fact, I got Executive Director Ben O'Quist to count them up last night. There has been 50 in total, which means, of course, there has been more than one a week. It's been a remarkable effort by the team here at the Institute, and special thanks to Ebony Bennett, hosting Nobel laureates, former prime ministers from Australia and New Zealand, leaders, political leaders, leaders from our universities, media, arts, health networks. It has been a wonderful conversation, and thanks so much. Today, a conversation about Australia's relationship with one of our closest neighbours, and this in a great new essay by one of our finest journalists, The High Road, What Australia Can Learn from New Zealand. In this wise and illuminating quarterly essay, Chief Political Correspondent for ABC 730, Laura Tingle, looks at leadership, character, and two nations in transition. New Zealand has been held up as a model for everything from privatisation to the conduct of politics to the response to COVID. Laura considers how both countries have been governed and the different way each has dealt with its colonial legacy. What could Australia learn from New Zealand and New Zealand from Australia? Laura Tingle is the Chief Political Correspondent for the ABC's nightly current affairs program 730. Laura is one of Australia's best journalists and top political analysts, and she spent most of her 35-year career in journalism reporting on Australia's and on Australian federal politics and the country's major policy debates. A journalist, author and essayist, she was formerly the political editor of the Australian Financial Review. And Laura is passionate too about fine music and is a member of the Canberra Choral Society's Alto Naughty Corner. Ben Oquist. Ben is a highly respected political analyst, commentator and political community communication strategist. He was appointed executive director at the Australia Institute in 2015. So he's been in this job for over 5 years. I'm not sure of Ben's singing ability, but I'm guessing tenor. Over to you, Ben and Laura.
Thank you, Alex. Lovely to have you introducing webinar today. And I know many in Canberra in particular love to hear you on air. So it's great to have you on air today. And thanks for the warm introduction. And hello to Laura. No, I won't be singing, but I am really looking forward to getting stuck into your quarterly essay. And what a delight it is to be able to talk about it. I want to get straight into it, really, and ask you the kind of big picture question, which is, why haven't we compared ourselves with New Zealand more? And you talk about so many parallels historically, recently, everything from dealing with the EU common market to electing prime ministers under the same slogans like it's time, to dealing with the floating of the dollar and financial crises. Why has it taken perhaps COVID and your essay to get us starting to compare each other more? You would have thought with such similarities in history and the close connections, so many, as you point out, just as a kind of throwaway line, how much of our tourism market is actually dependent upon New Zealanders coming here. Why do we spend so little time comparing ourselves to New Zealand?
Hi, Ben, and everybody out there. Look, what I argue in the essay is that the historical roots of that really do have a lot to do with Great Britain. The fact that for much of our history, for sort of 100 years post-Federation, or 120 years post-Federation and before, we were both competing for the attention and affection of Great Britain as colonies or outposts in various shapes and forms. So that meant that we were focused onto the other side of the world rather than on each other, even though there was really from very, very early days very strong links between the two. I mean, Maori were trading with the very earliest sort of settlements in New South Wales the Brits when they arrived in 1788. Somebody was saying to me yesterday, in fact, that they helped in some ways keep the starving colony alive. But there is this underpinning of that relationship, that it was both focused on Britain and competitive for Britain's attention, which I think explains a lot of the whole preparedness to go to war. You know, they used to compete with each other about who signed up first to join a British expedition somewhere else in the world. So I think that was quite important. I think more recently there's been, we've become very sort of insular in our discussions, and I think that tends to be the case in a lot of countries. We don't actually sort of ever think, oh, other countries might be doing the same thing as us, you know, maybe they're thinking about this. And while I think in Australia's case it's probably a little bit of a superiority complex, we go, oh, little New Zealand, you know, oh, well, what would they know? In New Zealand's case, they really do have this great sort of sense of independence. And it was sort of striking when I was talking to people about the really early periods of economic deregulation in New Zealand, which were running essentially a year behind Australia, because we elected Hawke and Keating in 83, they elected Longy and Douglas in 84. And I said, well, I suppose you were looking at what happened in Australia and thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe we should do that. And they just said, no, why would we do that? And that, in a way, reflects just the different development of the discussions and debates in the two countries. Australia sort of was almost forced into that deregulatory sort of fashion by what was going on in the world. It wasn't the agenda in which Labor had come into office on. And, of course, it was very much a consensus-based model that Bob Hawke pushed at the time. By comparison, Roger Douglas had a clear blueprint for really radical free market reform in his top drawer before he got into office and was determined to introduce it and get it through as quickly as possible because he thought that if he wouldn't ever get it through because it was almost destined to make sure that the government only lasted one term because it would be so unpopular. So there were different mindsets. And then, of course, there were differences in foreign policy positions, going back to the ANZUS alliance and differences over nuclear ships. So there was a range of reasons why we didn't sort of think of each other as comparable, even though the really amazing thing when you start to look at this last 30 or 40 years, as I do in the essay, so many things were happening which were more or less identical in terms of the debates we were having and in terms of the influences we were facing in both countries.
Mm. I want to throw right to the end of your essay because I think there's something very powerful about comparing yourself to other countries kind of in detail and opening up choices in debate and therefore in your society. The Australian Institute recently set up a Nordic Policy Centre for this reason as a way of demonstrating, comparing yourself mm-hmm. to countries that you don't normally compare yourself to.
I agree. The Nordic countries and Norway in particular is an interesting comparison as a resource-rich country. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, but I think there is a reflexive comparing ourselves with the United States and the United Kingdom in Australia, sometimes with Asian countries, but very little with New Zealand and certainly not Nordic countries. And I like to say that there's nothing more powerful than an idea, except an idea that has already come. And looking at a country's policies that have actually been implemented and how they've been perceived and how they've travelled can open up debate. But you touched on the deregulation theme that ran through a lot of New Zealand politics a little later than Australia's, but were kind of more disruptive in a way in New Zealand that really shaped it for some time to come. Why do you think it ran further and faster and harder in New Zealand than it did in Australia?
Well, I think it ran further and farther and harder, first and foremost, because there was this blueprint in place from Roger Douglas. And, you know, one of the interesting things, as you say, you know, the power of an idea is one thing, but it's also about who's in the discussion. And when you look at that period, Roger Douglas had these powerful allies in the Treasury and the Reserve Bank. They set up an organisation called the New Zealand Business Roundtable, which is akin to the Business Council of Australia, I suppose. They outsourced one of their Treasury officials to run that, Roger Kerr, who became a very powerful voice in New Zealand. And essentially there was an argument which was called TINA in New Zealand, which was there is no alternative. Now, you have to look at the different circumstances in New Zealand. It was massively subsidised and as an economy, to a really unsustainable level. So the need for them to really radically restructure was greater in New Zealand. But, you know, the obvious points are it's a unicameral system, that is, they've only got one chamber of parliament. It was very much, as they used to call it, an elected dictatorship in those terms. The executive government and particularly the prime minister had huge power. But basically it was a system where you could basically push all opposition in front of you and away and just sort of get on with things. Now, that wasn't the case in Australia, and it was particularly not the case because Hawke had come in on this consensus platform after the divisions of the Fraser years, and we had, wasn't just the Accord, but we had all those tripartite groups with the unions and business. Now, while the relationship with business became a bit more fractious over the years, the the ACTU, which still then represented sort of half of the workforce, had an effective seat at the table, at the cabinet table. So you had this, you actually had a public debate about whether these ideas were good enough or not. In New Zealand in those days, the debate was purely about, how fast you could implement them. There wasn't, and I remember being there in the 80s, and there wasn't all that much discussion about what the outcome might be at the end.
You mentioned the elected dictatorship there. Was one of the outcomes of that kind of rush of going faster and harder electoral reform in New Zealand? It's one of the things you talk about in the essay, and New Zealand now has a proportional system, unlike Australia. It's got a preferential system, and New Zealand kind of moved from that single-member electorate system to proportional representation. And was that a reaction to that, one? And two, how has that affected political culture? Because it's one of the things I wanted to talk about. Are there some lessons in New Zealand about the way it does politics or the way it conducts public policy that could be useful for Australia? Because, as you know, there is a kind of hankering for something different, or at least some people are thinking about how do we address what seems to be a steady decline and erosion of faith in politics in Australia that's even leading to a loss of trust in democracy itself. And what are the kind of democratic infrastructure lessons we might learn from New Zealand?
That's a big question, or questions there. So without a doubt, the change in electoral system was a response to, there had been pressure anyway because there was a sort of a gerrymander in New Zealand. The push to what's called MMP really took hold because both Labor, by the way, it radically altered things after it came in 1984, which it hadn't told voters it was going to do. And then National, the Conservative government that followed them in 1990, also did, basically meant that both major sides of politics had disabused the trust of the electorate. The change to the system was actually an accident. David Longy had misread his notes and accidentally agreed to have a referendum on a change in the system, and National then thought they had to agree. So it was a bit of a happenstance because, of course, the change doesn't benefit either of the major parties. And it's tended to be seen, that shift, which basically means that you're much more likely in as in the German system or even the ACT system to have a coalition of parties in government. It's tended to be seen in Australia as a blockage to reform. But in fact, both Helen Clark and John Key on both sides of politics have managed to get significant reforms through, partly because New Zealand politicians have had to learn to live with each other and be civilised and negotiate. And I would sort of argue, well, it basically means that you have to thrash out a coalition agreement before you form a government. So everybody knows what they're going to do beforehand. Everybody knows that they might have to be nice to the other parties in the system. And as a result, everybody does tend to be more civilised. Now, a couple of other factors that I think are important in this are Helen Clark makes the observation, in terms of Australia, Helen Clark makes the observation in the essay that because of our preferential system, well, she says that in New Zealand, you can only win by staying in the centre. And all the other minor parties on the right or the left or wherever they are, they can get in on their own right and then you can negotiate with them. In Australia, because of the preferential system, it tends to drag the parties out from the centre to try to capture those votes from the sidelines. You know, obviously, particularly somebody like Pauline Hanson's party with the Liberal, or the LNP in Queensland. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. The other thing that I think is really important in terms of the culture in New Zealand is the sort of non-parliamentary parties in the debate. Rupert Murdoch isn't really in New Zealand. He's there via Sky, but he does not have a major newspaper. And more's the point, there isn't a national newspaper in New Zealand. So you don't have this sort of dominant force in the media spouting one idea or not. They've never developed the culture wars as such. When we were having the Cronulla riots in Australia in the mid-2000s, they had a national leader, Don Brash, who tried to sort of play the race card, if you like, about settlements for Maori under the Treaty of Waitangi process. And he sort of lifted in the polls a bit and was picked up a little bit by sort of a couple of shock jocks, but it never gained the sort of momentum that those sorts of things have gained in Australia and become entrenched with as part of the political culture. Now, I don't finish my thoughts about all of this with a sort of an idea that we should change to MMP immediately. I don't think that necessarily works for us given our federated structure, but it does show the benefit, which we sometimes forget, of having multiple voices in the discussion. And I think we've seen that this year through the National Cabinet, the fact that it was the states who basically really pushed, Gladys Berejiklian and Dan Andrews really pushed Scott Morrison early on for the lockdown to occur. He was very reluctant to do it. And I think if you think about that, in both cases, it shows the benefit of having as many voices as possible in a discussion. And that should be the case, you know, whether it's talking about politicians, levels of government, or in media diversity. So I suppose it's not that I sort of come out of this saying we have to change our structures, but if you look at New Zealand, it can remind you that political discussions can actually be quite civilised and they don't have to be so completely, you know, sort of divided and ludicrously oversimplified as they have so often become here.
Mm. And do you think it's an interesting point about the state premiers being other voices, and obviously during COVID, one of the big political trends is the rise of the state premier and their power and authority and simple public knowledge of is massively more, and that's changing a dynamic in politics. But do you think, therefore, if there is a comparison with New Zealand there, is to make us think maybe about, well, let's put it this way. Normally in national political discussion, both the state's existence and the Senate's existence are presented as a roadblock on making Australia better, a roadblock on reform. They're structures that prevent good things happening. That's the kind of accepted kind of political narrative. Is therefore, even if it's not to suggest that Australia moved to MMP or proportional representation, is to make us think about those structures as potentially good, not bad, not something to be run down the whole time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, the Senate, as people would, I think, often say, sort of saves governments from themselves. I think a lot of people in the coalition would say that the fact that John Howard got a majority in the Senate was his undoing with work choices. The Senate can be such a source of, if it's used and perceived and regarded properly, as it should be, as a house of review that can improve legislation, not just purely as this sort of horse trading place that you don't actually regard as being legitimate. I think it gives you that flavour of those things. And I think with the states, I mean, I suppose I'm old enough to remember the days when there were as many political reporters and specialist reporters covering state politics as there were in federal politics, because the reality is that the states still do run most of our systems. And my sort of take has always been that what happened was that as the federal government deregulated and therefore lost all its, you know, levers to be able to affect people's lives, you found them increasingly talking about issues that were actually the preserve of the states, like schools, like hospitals, like education more generally, like law and order. These had always like infrastructure, these had always been the areas of state responsibility. Federal governments wanted to look like they were running the joint, so they started to talk about them. But COVID has just reinforced the fact that, in fact, it is the states that do these things, and it's the state governments who actually really understand how those systems work. So I think, you know, a takeout, oh, God, I've just said that, which is a terrible term, but a real thing that's come out of this period in the last 12 months is to sort of say, actually, it's a good thing to have all of these different voices. You know, and people don't like to have arguments. People don't like the blame shifting. I understand all of that. But I think it's best, it's, you know, more minds put to work on an idea are always a better outcome.
I want to switch up in a second to the role of Maori in New Zealand society and compared to how Australia deals with its Indigenous population. But just while we're on that topic, and what we should touch upon COVID, you mentioned the states kind of forcing Morrison's hand early on, and we forget that. You know, we had the mess over the Grand Prix, as you mentioned, and all those things about whether it was okay to shake hands and Morrison was still going to be going to the football. Why did New Zealand, why did Jacinda Ardern act so quickly to move what now transpires to have been the kind of correct health response faster and more easily than Australian political leadership?
Well, some people have actually suggested to me that one of the pragmatic reasons is that the New Zealand health system isn't actually much chop. You know, that one of the many sort of really bad outcomes of sort of radical sort of departure of government from the economy and cuts in government spending has been that the hospital system ain't much chop compared to Australia, so that it was going to be much more easily overrun. But I think despite the fact that Jacinda Ardern didn't have a majority in her own right at the beginning of this year, as she now does, the system there did still mean that she had a much more direct line of communication with all the various authorities who had to make an assessment about these things. And I think she just sort of read it much faster. I mean, New Zealand is a little place which bobs around with much more volatility than Australia does. It's much more reliant on international arrivals. And so therefore much more, even though we've got this, you know, massive number of people who've come to Australia every year that, or until now, it's not as obvious because so many of the people coming to New Zealand are short-term tourists rather than people coming on work visas or, you know, more permanent migration. So I think New Zealand was really very aware of how vulnerable it was to this virus and how easy it would be for it to close the borders and try to protect itself. And I mean, the interesting thing is, of course, they've also just done these huge dumps of releases of documents outlining their decisions under the equivalent of freedom of information. And they just sort of went, well, here's the problem and we've got to deal with it, and just got on with it. And it was a harder lockdown in New Zealand at the beginning, but the impact of it was that, you know, you never saw those wobbling bits of trust that we saw in Australia, or the backbiting. And in fact, one of the three opposition leaders she faced this year before the election actually saw the beginning of his demise because he was mildly critical of Ardern in a Facebook post.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I there's so many bits to get into this essay, and we're not going to do it justice in this hour, but I did want to talk about your chapter that kind of compares the Indigenous engagement from Australian governments and New Zealand. And I thought I'd start by just quoting back at you the former National Party Prime Minister, Bulger, who said, well, it was a question of New Zealand's honour. And it just struck me as such a powerful statement that you haven't, I can't imagine that such a statement being made in Australia, or haven't heard one at such a prominent level. And it seemed to kind of cut through the difference. And as you point out, it's not that there's not it's not been a perfect system by any means, Maori faced massive disadvantage in New Zealand that many Indigenous peoples have faced as a result of colonisation, of course. But what can Australia learn there?
Yeah, that was, I remember reading that quote and just being blown away by it. I thought it was just extraordinary. Just because you go, when was the last time anybody talked about honour in Australia about anything? Look, I think there are a couple of lessons out of what has happened. I mean, a lot of this history was contemporaneous. Basically, both sides of politics in the 90s said, right, we've got to address breaches of the Treaty of Waitangi, the original founding document of New Zealand, signed with Maori chiefs, not just contemporary ones but historic ones. This was when we were talking about Mabo and Wick. It was a big political issue. A lot of people in New Zealand, in Pākehā communities, the white communities, didn't like it. They said, well, we never signed the treaty. You know, all sounds a little bit familiar. But as Jim Bolger said, it became a matter of honour. And there was this sense that the country couldn't really move on until it dealt with it. Now, I think the important thing about the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal, which was the basis through which these were negotiated, was that it didn't just look at compensation claims. It was also looking at some of the other aspects of the treaty, which went to the status of Maori in the view of the Crown of the day. And that led to moves to truth-telling, reconciliation, the recording of history of wrongs, and eventually led to the establishment, I think, of the Maori language as an official language of the country. It's now officially bilingual. And so all of those things were really, really important. So I think the lessons out of that are, one, there were institutional changes where these things happened and where they could be heard. The second one was that, as some of the scholars in New Zealand say, even though that tribunal was there, it was brought back into the political mainstream. Political leaders took ownership and responsibility for getting these things sorted. And I think in Australia, we don't have, I mean, we've got a native title tribunal, but we don't have those structures. There isn't, in New Zealand, there's historically been a thing called the Maori Council, which has been a body which has, you know, at various times been able to help Maori sort of get their sort of political act together, if you like, and articulate what it is they need. So it's important to have the institutions in place, and it's important, of course, for political leaders to actually decide to, you know, try to take on these issues. And it's sort of so interesting to read that history of the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal process through the 90s and onwards, and then go and read the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Now, obviously, all the attention has been, or most of the attention on that has been about the voice to Parliament. But in fact, the statement is about all of those other things as well. It's about the Makarrata. It's about the coming together after a dispute. It's about a treaty. And I think those things are really important to then go back in and try to understand what a voice means. You know, it is a sort of a nebulous concept in a lot of ways. You know, it was seen as this sort of, it was seen as a room, it was seen as a third chamber of Parliament, but the subtleties of what having a voice means, you know, when even it wasn't just Terra Nullius, wasn't just something that happened in 1788, it was still reflected in the Constitution. You know, the importance of what that means, I think you get from the context of looking at both the New Zealand experience and then reading the Uluru Statement again with fresh eyes.
No. We might come back to that in the questions. I know, Alex, we wanted to get to the questions of the audience, and I'm going to sneak one more in, Alex, before get into it. All those people are out there listening. I know how many of you have joined the Australia Institute's webinar series, and particular today, we've had one of our record registrations today. Over 3,200 people have joined, and I know Alex wants to get to some of them. So hello to all of you, and I'm sure we'll get to your questions in a second. But I just wanted to touch on China, in case we didn't get a chance to go there later. And the you've got a section in the essay about China and the real differences in a strategic approach on trade and on anything. You quote, maybe that's something we can get to as well, Helen Clark observations there about how New Zealand is handling it. She quotes Kevin Rudd as a way of articulating what might be some differences. What's New Zealand's different approach to China? Are there any lessons, or is it just too different, a country and its relationship with the United States just too different for there to be lessons learned from New Zealand on its relationship with China, given the low ebb things have got to here?
So to do it really quickly, so you leave time for questions. I sort of argue that China, that New Zealand basically was a little bit too enthusiastic and wide-eyed about China in the early days. It basically saw it purely as a trading opportunity, to the alarm of some of the other Five Eyes intelligence partners, that it didn't sort of actually focus too much on the strategic issues. It certainly has started to do that in the last 3 or 4 years, but it's managed to do so in a much more nuanced way. It's managed to sort of get away with banning Huawei by saying, oh, look, this is purely a process of tenders. It's got nothing to do with China. So I think it's played the diplomacy much more adroitly than we have. But on the other hand, it's not as big a target, if you like. As I quoted, I think Hugh White in last week's column, saying, you know, Australia is sort of seen by China as sort of an example to be made of to other countries in Asia. China sees New Zealand as an example of the way countries should behave towards it, because it has been very low-key. And it was interesting that when Jacinda Ardern came out this week and effectively backed Australia's problems, shall we say, with the offensive tweet by China, she did it in a fairly smart way of just basically saying, well, this was disinformation and we never agree with disinformation. But the Global Times said something like, well, of course, New Zealand would have to say that because it's under the thumb of the big bully Australia, and we won't punish China. We won't punish New Zealand for this. So, you know, we're a much bigger strategic target, but New Zealand is very vulnerable in a way, because so much of its trade is now dependent on China, and China sees New Zealand as a soft spot. It would love to peel New Zealand away from the Five Eyes intelligence group. It knows it's got these sort of effectively 4 votes in international fora because of its links with small islands in the Pacific, and because it's got interests in Antarctica, where China wants to go. So they're an interesting comparison of the sorts of ways China plays to different countries in this part of the world. I don't know if we can learn anything from it, but I think they have been much more adroit in the way they've sort of publicly positioned themselves.
Adroitness and nuance aren't words that you generally use to describe Australian politics. Anyway, perhaps we'll get some from some nuance and adroitness from our audience.
Yes, there's an amazing chat going on and lots of questions. And this one from Melina Smith, who asks, Laura, why do you think Jacinda Ardern has such great leadership skills and emotional intelligence that resonate with many young voters?
Look, I think you either have it or you haven't got it, I think, with the emotional intelligence. But she's, you know, people who have dealt with her, you know, leader to leader, or, you know, as a politician, just say she just has this, you know, that is this extraordinary strength she's got. The really amazing thing about Jacinda Ardern really is that she became opposition leader weeks before she became prime minister. So she has been on this unbelievably steep learning curve, and so has had to learn about being a minister, being a prime minister, being in government, all of those things at the same time, dealing with a fractious coalition partner in her first 3 years, which meant that she, you know, wasn't able to get most of her agenda through. And in fact, at the beginning of the year, there were real questions about whether she was actually going to win this election. So it just shows you how things change. But I think emotional intelligence is just one of those things you either have or you haven't, and people pick it up. And, you know, they, as they say, they spot a phony a million miles away. And if you're a phony, you probably won't make it in politics.
Laura, could I butt in there, Alex, and ask, just while we're on Jacinda Ardern and the emotional intelligence, she's also a global figure. And New Zealand's got a bit of a tradition of that. I mean, I even think of Longy in that terms as an internationalist. And, of course, Helen Clark, one of the great international leaders or diplomats, and Jacinda seems to fit into that tradition. What are the qualities that have made New Zealand produce leaders like that? Why is Helen Clark did so well as the Prime Minister and now internationally, and now Jacinda Ardern?
Well, I mean, they're all sort of interesting characters in their own right, but there's this sort of endearingly, charmingly frank quality to New Zealand politicians, which is really terrific. I think the fact that they did break away from the US made them a figure of intrigue to the Western world in sort of through the 80s and 90s. And New Zealand also took this very practical view that since they didn't have a big brother in the background, except perhaps Australia, they had to make themselves useful. So the best way of making themselves useful was as the, you know, go-to multilateralists, multinationalists, and they prosecuted that case in all of those international fora by being, you know, agreeable and useful, but always their own people. So they went to Afghanistan, but they didn't go to Iraq, and were always very straight about it. So I think that's given all of the New Zealand prime ministers a really good platform, because it's not like that, you know, they're not seen as Australia, unfortunately, is as somebody who's going to be more or less echoing the US. They're always going to have an interesting view on things.
Another question here from Jordan King. Laura, does New Zealand and Australia need more talking infrastructure, i.e. civil society dialogue and a spirit of sharing and comparing across our public institutions? Would this help both sides value knowledge of the other?
Well, absolutely. As we say, it's sort of a mystery that we know so little about each other's discussions. You go and have a look at it, and we've been conducting on both sides of the Tasman often discussions that are exactly the same, and we didn't know that other people were doing it. One thing that does happen a lot, which, you know, is in the dull sort of recesses of bureaucracy, and therefore we don't see it, is New Zealand talks a lot to the states. They spend a lot of time with state governments, New Zealand officials. And New Zealand is actually represented on a lot of, COAG is now a bit of a thing of the past as well, but New Zealand's actually on a lot of those COAG ministerial councils. So, you know, at a governmental level, there is a lot of discussion, but as you say, in civil society, I'm not sure that it is there as much. There is some in areas of Indigenous policy, I know, some in welfare policy, but one of my problems when I was doing the essay was that there aren't actually a lot of people who really, really know a lot about both countries, you know, in a really, you know, pragmatic how stuff happens sort of way. It's a very small pool. So get out there and talk to your Kiwi counterparts.
But what do you think that's about, Laura? Why is that the case? Why is there such a small pool? Why have we been so not so curious about each other?
Look, you know, you could say, why aren't we more curious about what's happening in other states? I mean, New Zealand does have a bit of a chip on its shoulder often about the fact that Australia doesn't pay much attention to it and can be a little bit obsessive about what we're doing. But I just think we've been consumed by all of our internal debates. We've been consumed by our relationship with China, the United States, you know, the whole question of whether we should be part of Asia. It's been, you know, such a dialogue over the last 20 or 30 years. As when Britain cast us both out in 1973, when it went to join the common market, suddenly we were going, well, who are we? So we were looking at trying to reinvent ourselves in this part of the world, and thinking we needed to engage with Asia in particular. So we weren't really thinking about New Zealand. So I just think we've sort of never really got into the habit of it.
Ben, did you want to come in there?
No, I wanted to touch on a point that the significance of not doing that and what it might help us do, and just quote a little bit from Laura's essay, use this opportunity to quote that and let people know that they should read it. I know hundreds of you have taken up the Australia Institute's discount offer to buy it, so good on you. The mantras that dominate, this is towards the closing of your essay, Laura, the mantras that dominate Australian politics now are just as entrenched as the ones which once endorsed centralised wage fixing, high tariff barriers. They're so entrenched, they're almost unspoken, but often couched in Australia in the mode of thwarted ambition rather than philosophical endpoints. Government spending should be lower. Taxes should be lower. Government does things worse than the private sector. There are too many blocks to development. The wages system is not flexible enough. All those kind of unspoken truths that dominate Australian politics that we too rarely think about. And is the comparison with New Zealand help us unpack some of those things, or do they reinforce some of those mantras?
Well, I think they should both unpack them and they should not reinforce them because one of them, it just, I suppose what I was hoping to do in the essay was to sort of say, well, you know, look, what has happened in New Zealand shows that it doesn't necessarily have to be so, you know, whether it's Indigenous affairs, foreign policy or economic policy. But I think the reality is that the experience of New Zealand in the economic field in particular is not a good ad for radical free market deregulation, particularly in a small economy. It has not achieved better outcomes as it was predicted would do. Wages have fallen. Productivity has not risen. The best you can say is that their budget is basically, as the pandemic hit, more or less in the same position as Australia's was. So I think it does give us reason to stop and go, well, you know, are those things actually right? And I'm not saying that, you know, you suddenly go out and re-regulate the economy, or that you go out and, you know, have huge amounts of spending that you don't need or any of those things, but it gives us reason to go, well, it isn't necessarily the case in small economies like ours that you will get a good outcome. That's partly because of things that are very dull but really important, like the structures of our markets. Like Australia, New Zealand has a lot of duopolies, monopolies, and it just doesn't work that you privatise them. And New Zealand has actually moved to purchase privatised government assets and instrumentalities in a lot of cases, just because it really just didn't work. So I think we should be more open to these ideas and look at what New Zealand's done and say, yeah, well, sometimes it doesn't work and we should just, you know, think more clearly about these things and not be so stuck.
A question from Martin Paolo. Are New Zealand people less accepting of ministerial misbehaviour than Australians?
Well, look, I've got to say, I didn't really get into ministerial misbehaviour as such. You know, I was trying to avoid the sort of scandal level of politics in all of this. But I don't think they are. I think they're just as intolerant of it. You know, if you looked at the day-to-day news coverage in New Zealand, you know, there were the same sort of controversies about who people talked to and, you know, what they did and, you know, did they do it on taxpayers' expense as there is in Australia. So I think that they're just as intolerant of it here as they are there as they are here.
What about Laura then? Kind of related area which I did want to touch on, which is the public service there and its role and structure and independence. I mean, perhaps the related one about transparency in, you referred to some cabinet documents being released, and I know they've got a system where cabinet documents are released much more quickly and easily and transparently. Is there something about the New Zealand public service that delivers better policy advice?
I think it's interesting that the Australian public service will sort of quietly sort of say that they're a bit in awe of the quality of the public service in New Zealand, that it is actually, you know, for the size of the country and everything else, it's better. It hasn't been as politicised, and it's sort of interesting that even though, you know, the New Zealand economy starts in the 80s as this economy which is a huge amount of which was sort of government, in the government sector, you know, forestry, electricity, telecommunications, whatever. When that was corporatised and privatised, the essential public service structure of public service advice sort of seemed to survive all of that. And so you didn't get the sort of Knights of the Long Knives, you didn't get the sort of the contempt for the public service advice, you didn't get the huge rise in ministerial offices, though I think it's probably happened to some extent. So, you know, my other favourite, or one of my other favourite hobby horses about institutional memory is much stronger, I think, in New Zealand in the public service. And I think that's, you know, that's been an enormous benefit to them.
A question from Chris Minaj. Laura, to what extent do demographic divisions / culture wars between the inner burbs versus the outer burbs / rural regions exist? Are these the major stumbling points for necessary reform? And does it mean the current unravelling of the United States society is a glimpse into our future selves?
Well, I suppose it's true that New Zealand is more, you know, homogenous is probably too strong, but, you know, there's not the sort of, you know, divide that you might get between far north Queensland and, you know, inner city Melbourne. People talk a lot about Auckland versus the rest of New Zealand a lot in terms of the way people see themselves. New Zealand has also changed a lot more socially as a result of all of those radical changes. It was a society where there were a lot of people living, you know, in small rural towns in the 80s. A lot of those jobs disappeared, so there was a move to the cities. I think that does change it. And, of course, the other thing that is profoundly different is that it's much more a bicultural society rather than a multicultural one. It's predominantly Pākehā, that's white Kiwis and Māori, but, of course, now there's also the Pacifica community. And just in the last 10 years or so, a lot more Asian migrants are coming in, but nowhere in the sorts of numbers we've seen in Australia. So, you know, there are different sort of social dynamics and demographic dynamics at play there.
Just following on, I think, from the question about China, Jennifer Raper asks, would it be profitable for New Zealand and Australia to be more allied, create a neutral bloc in the Southwest Pacific?
Oh, absolutely. And it's sort of interesting. I know both Australia and New Zealand, when you talk to officials, they tend to be a little bit sort of sniffy about the way they variously approach the Pacific. Kiwi officials will say that Australia tends to want to stomp in and tell everybody how to do things, whereas New Zealand does things in a much more cooperative fashion. Look, I don't know enough about the stuff on the ground to know whether, you know, either or both of those things is true. But I think without a doubt, you know, Australia's sudden and I think belated realisation, though they insist that they always knew this really, that, you know, suddenly China was in the Pacific and, gosh, how did that happen, has, you know, forced us to think about what we do in the Pacific and how we use our influence. And once again, Helen Clark, who's sort of very wise on these things, says, look, it's not about how much we spend. We're never going to be able to outspend China and the Pacific building, you know, pretty awful buildings, convention centres they won't use or whatever. What we can provide in both Australia and New Zealand is what they need most, which is the really old-fashioned things, which is access to our education systems, access to our health systems. And, you know, I think it'd be great if there was more of a joint effort by Australia and New Zealand in the Pacific to sort of look at those things. It sort of feels like we tend to sort of operate a bit separately and, as I said, with a little bit of disdain for each other in the way we approach these things.
John has it, and it goes to the conversation that you were having earlier. Which country has handled its Indigenous affairs more effectively in recent years?
Oh, well, I think without a doubt New Zealand has. You know, as we've discussed, you know, inequality for Māori is still a real problem, but it's not as bad as and on a range of measures they're worse than Pākehā and Kiwis, but not as bad as the gap between Australia's First Peoples and the rest of the community. But I think those institutional changes we've discussed, without a doubt, mean that there are structures in place for dealing with these issues. Some of the iwi or tribes who've struck settlements, which in no way reflect the full value of their loss, but are struck in a way to try to give them an economic base from which to work, have really prospered and are doing very, very well. So that is sort of an encouragement. It does happen in Australia, but we don't, and it's not necessarily about a voice to Parliament. We don't even have, you know, it's obviously also a more complex issue in Australia because of both language differences and you know, more scattered cultural differences within our First Nations. But we don't even have very good regional cultural structures and economic structures in place. So without a doubt, New Zealand's done better in those things.
Mm. And was that, you know, in recent days a real turning point when the school kids did the haka following the Christchurch massacre and the use of language, of Maori language?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you attend public events in New Zealand, it's not just an acknowledgement of country. You know, quite a lot of the early parts of an official speech will all be done in Maori language. And, you know, people are learning it, and the parliament is conducted bilingually as well.
Ben, did you want to have the final question before we wrap?
I was just going to reflect upon that and how shocking it was that the rugby union team sang the Australian anthem in Indigenous language the other day. I mean, it's all sorts of controversy around it, but just the fact that it was so surprising in 2020 that those kind of things aren't part of our culture, and as Laura reflects in the book, it's just that Maori culture is central to New Zealand culture, not another. It's right there at the centre. I thought I'd go back to the obvious thing to wrap up, Laura, and talk about COVID and the dueling responses. And you know, there's been a big debate about putting health before economy or economy before health, and you had to do both at both, and lockdowns might have looked good, but economically they've done badly, some say. What's the economic experience from New Zealand? Has it worked economically for them to have taken the health response that Jacinda led?
I think the jury is still out on that. Their statistical collection runs a little bit slower than ours. They went down much more sharply than we did in the early stages of the pandemic, but life has essentially returned to normal within New Zealand since then. And so the big question becomes, is that going to be enough to sustain them until borders can open again? Because they're continuing to take a really tough line. I mean, yesterday we saw the confirmation that our borders would be closed until March. The Kiwis aren't talking about opening borders anytime soon, at least till the middle of the year and possibly the end of the year, which is a huge call when so much of their economy relies on tourism. So their stimulus by our standards was massive. So a lot of the measures are permanent.
Was it different style of stimulus? I know you reflected at one point in the essay about the treatment of the art sector, for example, something we've pointed out. You know, you get 9 jobs for every $1 million spent in the arts compared to one in construction. Ours has been very construction focused. Was there a difference that's not just in size but in approach about how they spent the money?
Look, not all that different. I mean, certainly the arts was one standout, and it was interesting because they argued that on the basis that having seen how important the arts were in the aftermath of the Christchurch earthquakes economically, you know, they strode into that with great confidence. But other than that, a lot of the measures were very, very similar to what Australia did, but just on a bigger scale. And, for example, the sort of equivalent of, shall we say, JobKeeper type payments, they said, well, you know, or the job seeker payments, that they were permanent increases in income. So people aren't going through that whole thing of saying, oh, well, I'm just about to lose all of this money and creating uncertainty. So a lot of the things were very similar. But if you take the view that, they're not going to open the borders for maybe 12 months, and will therefore be having to prop up a lot of sectors like tourism for a really long time, you'll actually sort of see this, you know, quite fascinating return to government being a massive influence and proportion of the New Zealand economy, as it was when Jacinda Ardern was 4 years old on the day that David Longley was sworn in as Prime Minister, probably for the next 4 or 5 years. And then it will have to sort of then unwind and work out where it wants to go next, and how far it, I think everybody in the world will be borrowing lots of money and government, you know, while interest rates remain low. But it will have to be rethinking whether it can diversify its markets for its goods away from China and really just, you know, much more so than we are, having an open conversation about how much of a role government should and needs to play in such a small economy.
Look, we'll have to wrap it there. There's a message from Edwina Brown, I noticed in the chat, probably speaks for us all. Thank you so much, Laura. I'm going to buy your essay and read it as soon as possible. Thank you also to the Australia Institute for this presentation. Yes, thank you, Laura, very much. And the essay is called The High Road, What Australia Can Learn from New Zealand. It's available now. Thanks too to Ben Oakhurst, Executive Director of the Australia Institute. It's been a really great conversation. And thank you again to you and the amazing team here at the Australia Institute for an outstanding year in the face of this pandemic, all with the aim of making Australia a better place. And thank you, everyone, for your amazing questions. I'm sorry we only got to a tiny proportion of them, but it's been a very, very lively discussion. And make sure you subscribe to our podcast, Follow the Money. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you normally listen to podcasts. There's some great summer listening there, wherever you may be travelling and hopefully resting. Please take great care, follow the COVID rules, and the Australia Institute looks forward to rolling out more webinars, great campaigns and research in 2021. Thanks so much for your time today, and spread the word. Thank you so much, Laura Tingle and Ben Oakhurst. And thank you to you.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Ben.
This has been a special summer episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel. Or you can find all our latest research and content at our website, australiainstitute.org.au. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. And Laura Tingle is at La Tingle. That's LATINGLE. Ben Oakhurst is at Ben Oakhurst. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Remember, stay safe and thanks for listening.